everyone. My name is Maria Thomas, and I work for Allianz Research, the global team of economists, strategists, sector advisors, and foresight experts of the Allianz Group, led by Ludovic Subron. Welcome to Tomorrow, a podcast where we'll be talking about our latest analyses of economic and capital market developments, as well as our views on trends affecting risk management. Let's get started. How have European labor markets fared in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic? In this episode, with senior economist Maddalena Martini and economist Patricia Pelayo Romero, we look at the impact on employment, wages, and productivity, and what that means for policymakers. Hello, Maddalena and Patricia. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Maria.
Hi, Maria. Thank you.
So, 3 years after the pandemic broke out, how are Eurozone labor markets faring?
Labor markets across the Eurozone fared better than expected during both the pandemic crisis and the energy crisis. Also because the government stepped in with the comprehensive fiscal support schemes to protect the labor markets that amounted around 2% of GDP. So unemployment rates suddenly increased in 2020. But then, but not markedly as we initially expected. And also, there was a strong recovery that brought the unemployment rate down to 6.5% in March from the peak in September 2020. And this is also a record low level for the Eurozone unemployment rate. And employment, on the other side, has returned to pre-crisis level already at the beginning of last year, so the beginning of 2022, and recorded an increase of 2.3% compared to end of 2018. But on the other side, average hours worker declined over the same period. Looking also at the participation rates, we saw that they have quickly recovered in Germany and in France, while they are returning more slowly to pre-pandemic levels in Spain and in Italy. Also, given that discouraged groups in these countries exited the labor market in 2020, in the most acute phase of the crisis, of the pandemic, and they are only slowly returning to the labor market. And despite we are observing this increase in participation rates, the labor markets across the Eurozone remains quite tight. So with we are observing historically high levels of vacancy rates. And also, yes, this decline in hours worked, the decline over the period about 1.7%. And this is due to a mix of reasons that we can mention here. For example, can be also due to a shift in workers' preferences, like they are working less hours, and also the strong employment creation in sector that usually see lower hours worked, like the public sector. Another point that we observe in our analysis was the no apparent reallocation among sector in the Eurozone. But mostly we observe an increase in job-to-jobs transition. So that are usually driven by a salary gain. So people move jobs on for better pay. And also this is due to the pressure that comes from the high inflation environment we are in currently. So all in all, despite the deteriorating economic outlook that we are facing, and we see that employment intention coming from the surveys, for example, the PMIs or the economic sentiment indicator, remain very strong at a solid level. And so for this reason, we see that the rise in unemployment rate in the next couple of years, so in 2023 and 2024, will be only limited across the major four economies of the bloc.
So you write in the report that while we're seeing more jobs, there's less productivity. Can you tell us why and what that could mean for the Eurozone economy?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. Let's define productivity for a second, because if you are part of the econ community, you know that it's quite the controversial topic. And there are many definitions that we sometimes use. But for the purpose of this analysis, we talked about output per hour worked. So Madalena already mentioned that during the pandemic, policymakers tried to protect employment and implemented the reduced working hours to dissuade companies from laying off workers. As a result, labor productivity improved, but only temporarily before reverting to the long-term low growth trend, since this reduced labor input matched the decline of economic activity. Job creation has slowed in many countries like Germany, Italy, and the US. However, in Italy and the US, we have seen a depressed labor participation that has hindered strong job gains. In Italy, a large portion of the disadvantaged groups exited the labor market during the crisis and are only now gradually returning to work. In the US, it's been a function of slower immigration, earlier retirement, and unfortunately, the excess deaths due to COVID. And they have created, this perfect storm has been created in which there are now 3.5 million workers missing, according to estimations from the US Fed. So other relevant explanations of weak productivity growth are related to the difficulty of implementing innovations after the pandemic, or some labor reorganizations that we've seen because of remote work, for example. At the end of the day, we care about productivity because it is the most important driver of long-term income growth, which directly influences living standards, competitiveness, and the economy for sure.
Okay, and since inflation remains high, are you seeing any signs of a wage price spiral?
Of course, when we saw the surge in prices in late 2021, then got exacerbated by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the consequent energy crisis, there was the so-called wage prices spiral fears. So we looked into it, and we try to model this the price dynamics and the drivers of this price dynamics, and to see if these are the fears are justified and what will happen in the coming quarters. So we saw that there are kind of two group of countries. So we distinguish between the core countries, so Germany and France, and the periphery, Spain and Italy. We observe different wage dynamics. So, for example, for Italy and Spain, we saw that past inflation has a higher explanatory power. So 1 year ahead, inflation figure will play a more significant role in the current wage dynamics. And this is also because probably the influence of the unions in the wage bargaining in the peripheral countries were like sometimes, also what happened during the crisis, more gradual wage increase is preferred in exchange of job security, because usually are countries that experience larger swings in unemployment rates during the crisis. And also the productivity gains in these two countries have a large impact on wage changes. So in Italy and Spain, around 0.7 percentage point, while in France and Germany, around 0.3 percentage point. So we are observing, as Patricia was saying, finding like a labor productivity trends that can suggest that there will be some downward pressure on future wage bargaining. Together with weakened economic prospects we are seeing now. So this means that there will be a likely slightly increase in unemployment rate. So this should also limit the wage increase this year. Our forecast points that consider both the modeling part that is able to explain around 50% of the wage growth, but also structural issues of the labor market that are quite different across the four countries we consider it. And we see now that there will be a 5% increase in wage in Germany this year, followed by Spain at 4.6%, and then 4.5 in Italy, and then 4.1 in France. In 2024, given the high explanatory power of inflation in wage growth, since we see also inflation gradually normalizing, we also see that the wage gains will be around 3.5 and 4%. So we remain cautious about the pressures on wage, but also we don't see an imminent wage price spiral.
You also looked into a question that's on everyone's minds at the moment. How will AI disrupt labor markets? What do you find?
Yes, it is certainly the million-dollar question. So I would like to start with the best case scenario, which is AI becoming a labor-enabling factor. So labor-saving technological advances could be an antidote to this labor scarcity that we've been mentioning, especially in aging societies, although it would have to be properly distributed across income groups. So much has been talked about in regards to job displacement, but it could be a blessing in disguise in countries with a shrinking workforce due to its rapidly aging populations, especially China, many European countries like Italy, and another Asian economy that has seen it happen for a while, Japan. However, in the past, we've seen that it was the low-skilled workers that stood to lose more from these technological advances. Innovation in agriculture led to almost no benefits for the workers in this sector, while industrialization took craft work out of homes and into factories with increased surveillance for managers, decreased pay, and longer hours. So we basically did not see much of a welfare gain in this instance. However, this time it could be different, as AI technologies are promising to be able to carry out tasks of the higher skilled workers. It could be a blessing in disguise in the sense that we do have labor shortages, but it does leave space for wondering about the worst case scenario, which could mean major labor displacement. However, the fruition of this risk depends on the rate of adoption of AI, which in itself is influenced by the reliability of these technologies, the regulation that we implement, and the organization of labor markets. The problem would be if these new technologies permanently diminish wage bargaining power and could counteract with these skill shortages. There were some papers published recently, one from OpenAI, the creator of ChatGPT, that finds that nearly one in four U.S. workers may see at least half of their work impacted by the introduction of large language models. Similarly, a report by Goldman Sachs concluded that about 300 million jobs globally could be affected by the same adoption of these LLMs. Undoubtedly, increasing automation will change the types of skills that employers demand from workers. And this time, it might affect different sectors than it did in the past. However, the impact that AI could have on wages can be mitigated by increasing workers' bargaining power. Countries better positioned to integrate these new technologies in the workplace without causing social dislocations are those that have stronger trade unions or higher rates of collective bargaining. Of course, these technologies can also bring opportunities for growth and prosperity by improving labor productivity, by lower transaction costs, and by reducing the barriers to market entry, which could in turn accelerate innovation and induce a virtuous circle of growth and productivity gains and creating new jobs and new occupations. But it all really does depend on how we regulate them.
Okay, so what does all of this mean for policymakers?
So it is, I think, prime time to look at production economics and social welfare. However, the labor market policies really do need to focus on up and reskilling to tackle the challenges from AI. Reskilling has already been successfully implemented in, for example, enabling credit analysts to become data analysts, or workers in the fossil fuel industry to transfer their expertise into renewable energy generation. So there is this space of areas in which we can adapt those skills that have close occupational proximity. For example, there's also the fact that during this digital transformation that we've been seeing, accountant clerks have become cybersecurity officers, which are in high demand. So the current policy discussion on digitalization, and in particular in AI, underscores the importance of having a multi-stakeholder approach so that we manage to not see this major labor displacement. The European Commission has already proposed a risk-based legal framework for AI that defines some levels of risk that go from minimal to unacceptable. And they have this circular policy-making tool in which they hope to have policies evolve and adapt as much or as fast as AI is evolving. So the private sector has already also put forward some top line recommendations for regulating AI, which includes taking a sectoral approach, promoting an interoperable approach to AI standards and governance, and ensuring parity in expectations between non-AI and AI systems that promote accountability. However, I think that it's really important that we do take this multi-stakeholder approach, because it is not something that only concerns policymakers and the private sector, but it also concerns workers and the path that we want to follow going forward on this AI revolution. There have been already some very important advances in labor market policies, and policymakers have already proved to be responsive in crisis, for example, during the pandemic. So it's now time to test them again and minimize the potential scarring that AI could create in the labor force. So I think that it's also important to rethink social protection. But if you want to know more about that, go ahead and read the report.
Thank you very much, Patricia and Madlena.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find the full report we just spoke about on our website. We'll leave a link in the show notes. If you'd like to discover more of our research, you can also follow the Ludonomics newsletter on LinkedIn. We'll leave a link down below for that too. If you like the podcast, please send it to any of your friends who might like it too, and leave us a rating and a review. We'd love to hear your feedback. In the meantime, stay tuned for the next episode.